Welcome to The Record on KUOW Seattle. I'm Bill Radke. We're going to go to a place that was the Wild West for bike shares, Dallas, Texas, but they're changing things around a little bit, and Seattle's considering some changes too, so we'll find out about that. First, our top story this hour, gun rights groups are suing the city of Seattle over Seattle's new law requiring gun owners to lock up firearms. The National Rifle Association, Bellevue's Second Amendment Foundation, and two Seattle residents are behind this lawsuit challenging the city's gun storage law. Mayor Durkan proposed and signed the legislation earlier this month. If you don't properly secure your stored firearm, then under this law, you could face fines from $500 up to $10,000. We're joined now by Robert Spitzer, Distinguished Service Professor at the State University of New York, Cortland, and author of five books on gun policy, most recently, The Politics of Gun Control. Welcome, Robert.
Good to be with you.
You are a member of both the NRA and the Brady Campaign to Prevent Gun Violence, which to some of us has come to sound like maybe a contradiction. Would you explain?
Well, yeah, I'm a member of both organizations and have been for many years, and there are two reasons why. One is because I study gun policy, and it's helpful for me as an academic to see how these organizations operate from the inside as an average member. And the other thing is that it freaks out my students. It confuses them. Uh-huh. And anything that confuses them is good.
Yes. You want a student off balance. As I think it's
That's
good to
right.
be off balance in general in life. Okay. So we spoke to this gun rights group, the Second Amendment Foundation, based near Seattle here in Bellevue. And they told us that obviously they're not against gun safety, but there is a Washington state law that says that cities cannot regulate guns. So how could Seattle's law be permissible?
Well, there are two elements to the legal question. One is sort of the background standard set by the Supreme Court back in 2008 in its D.C. versus Heller decision. That was the court case that established a personal right for people, average people, to have a handgun for their own self-protection in their home. And in that decision, it set out that right, but it also provided a list of other kinds of laws that would be allowable under the Heller standard, and one of them was laws regarding safe storage of guns, of firearms. And so, just as a general matter in terms of Second Amendment rights, it's pretty clear that laws pertaining to safe storage are allowable.
Okay, now, so separate from the Washington state law, you're saying the NRA has not had good success in knocking down safe storage laws.
Well, in terms of the Second Amendment, that's right. Yeah. And in terms of other kinds of laws, too, the vast majority of legal challenges to all kinds of gun laws have failed from 2008 up to the present. Mm-hmm. But the other question, of course, is Washington State's preemption law, which says that localities may not enact gun regulations stricter than the state standard. And that preemption laws are pretty strong in these kinds of areas. However, the subject of safe storage is not among the listed categories of gun-related prohibitions or gun-related laws that the preemption law prohibits to localities. There is some more general language that suggests maybe localities couldn't do that either, but that is at least an open question in terms of litigation. And as you know, in 2010, Seattle passed a law barring guns from parks that was struck down by state court as a violation of preemption, but in 2017, a state court upheld Seattle's local tax on firearms, and a tax is a government regulation too. So it's a bit of an open question which way it will go.
Right. When that tax came out last year, opponents had argued that's, as you say, a kind of regulation. Cities can't do that. And the Washington State Supreme Court said that Seattle tax was okay. So on balance, any take on this Seattle law on requiring people to lock up their firearms? Do you think you see where this lawsuit is going?
I think the likelihood that the law will be struck down ultimately is more likely than it would be upheld. But there is a viable argument I think you can make on behalf of the law. And it's always a hazardous business to try and predict what courts will do. Mm-hmm. But just based on the nature of preemption laws and remembering that local governments of all varieties are legal creatures of the states wherein they reside. It gives states a great deal of legal discretion to enact preemption-type laws, so I think the advantage is with the opponents of the law. But we'll see what the courts say.
And I suppose if the legislature were feeling enough heat, then the legislature could change the state law. All that is a ways down the road. Go on.
Yes, the legislature could absolutely intervene and alter the legal framework if it chose.
Mm-hmm. Now, what about the topic of the locking of a gun? You know, some of the plaintiffs in this case say, well, I keep my gun unlocked because I want it to be ready to repel an intruder at a moment's notice. And we have technology evolving all this time. So can a gun be safe and effective in an emergency?
Well, it can be under the right circumstances, but virtually all gun owners, responsible gun owners, understand that guns are dangerous and that they should be kept locked up, that ammunition should be kept in a separate location, that the gun should be unloaded. Now, that does mean that you don't have ready access to it. It's not sitting loaded on your coffee table, although maybe some people do that. It's not a good idea for the simple and obvious reason that a gun that is available, that is not locked up, is available to be stolen, to be absconded with by a child, to be grabbed by a despondent, suicidal teenager. It can be subject to all kinds of adverse consequences that we know statistically outweigh the likelihood that a gun would actually be used successfully to defend yourself in the home. So the risks, without question, there have been many, many studies about this, the risks far outweigh the benefits of just having a gun around the house, available, accessible, loaded, and not locked.
And what about the fines associated with this Seattle law? So the legislation would allow a fine up to $500 just for a gun not being locked up when it's stored, up to $1,000 if a prohibited person gets a hold of a firearm, and fines up to $10,000 when a prohibited person uses that weapon to hurt somebody or uses it to commit a crime. Is there any particular controversy over linking violations with those kind of fines?
Well, of course, the fines are the stick element of the law. It's the penalty. If a law doesn't have a penalty element to it, what's the incentive of people to follow the law? And those dollar numbers are not, I think you could reasonably argue that the dollar numbers are not out of line with the kind of fine that might be imposed for other kinds of legal violations, especially if the gun winds up being used in a crime. You know, somebody kills another person, it winds up in being involved in a suicide or other sorts of things. So the dollar amounts attached to the law do not seem excessive.
And finally, Robert, we have this ongoing decades-long story of gun control measures being proposed, and then there's a fight in the court of public opinion and legal fights. You know, we have a big reaction after a shooting, of course. What do you have any thoughts on what the bigger picture is here? You yourself embody a balance of someone who's a member of the NRA and also a member of the Brady Campaign to Prevent Gun Violence. Do you have any insight into where this long debate is headed in the states?
Well, that's a good question. We have seen a lot more action in the states, especially in the last 5 or 6 years, states enacting all kinds of new laws, both states enacting tougher laws like Washington State and others, and also states going in the other direction, more conservative states enacting laws, making it easier to have guns and to get guns. The thing is, the long-term trend is against greater gun ownership, simply because if you look at the overall numbers and graph them going back 30, 40, 50 years, fewer and fewer Americans own guns and are interested in guns. It's just not an activity, a habit, a tradition that is being very much passed along from one generation to another. So the long-term trend is one of less gun ownership and not more gun ownership, although the average gun owner owns a much larger average of guns than was true, let's say, 40 or 50 years ago. So that at least is the broad outline of where things seem to be heading down the road.
This is Robert Spitzer, Distinguished Service Professor at the State University of New York, Cortland, and he's written 5 books on gun policy, most recently called The Politics of Gun Control, which is some of what we're talking about here, with some gun rights groups suing the city of Seattle over its new law requiring gun owners to lock up firearms. Professor Spitzer, it's good to talk with you. Thank you for this.
Yeah, I enjoyed speaking with you.
And speaking of the NRA, we had gun rights and Russian meddling coming together last week. Did you hear about this? The Russian national Maria Butina was arrested on charges of being an unregistered foreign agent. And she had an ongoing professional relationship with a Bellevue gun rights activist, which can raise some questions about Second Amendment groups and foreign influence. So here to help us sort through this is a Russia expert, Jill Doherty, CNN correspondent for 3 decades and now a visiting practitioner at the University of Washington's Evans School of Public Policy. Welcome, Jill.
Hey, thank you very much, Bill.
Good to have you here. First of all, before we talk about this case with this unregistered foreign agent, any thoughts on the discussion you just heard about I don't even know that there was a gun rights debate raging in Russia, but how the situation in Russia compares with what's going on here.
You know, it's really fascinating because in Russia, this really was not much of an issue. Traditionally, you had in the old Soviet days, you had people who were trained militarily. In fact, back in the 1960s, I remember, and 70s, young kids who went to the pioneer camp had to dismantle like a Kalashnikov and put it back together again.
Yes.
But it was all in the context of the military. And now what we have, and this is where Butina comes in, is this kind of nascent, you know, just beginning movement for gun rights, and more in, I'd say, the style of a very expansive Second Amendment American concept of the right to have guns. I'll tell you something interesting. You know, when I was looking at a little research this morning, in fact, I came upon a poster, and it's a Russian language poster, and it says, almost a quote, "The right of the people to have weapons shall not be infringed," et cetera, et cetera. And I thought, that's interesting. That doesn't sound very Russian to me. And indeed, it wasn't. It was a quote from some type of a ruling in Texas in the 1850s. So what you're getting now is, because of the contact, and we can talk more about this, the contact between American gun rights supporters, NRA, and Russians, you're getting a little bit more cross-pollination, shall we call it, for supporting gun rights, whereas for a long time, it really hasn't been an issue in Russia.
Well, let's talk about this Russian-American contact. I mentioned this Russian national who's been arrested, and I mentioned her professional workings with this gun rights activist here in Bellevue. What was going on?
Well, let's back up a little bit. Kind of an intriguing case. 29 years old, red hair, not that that makes any difference. she was a student at American University, apparently a good one, getting her master's, etc. But she had kind of this side thing, which was guns. And she founded an organization that's called Right to Bear Arms. It's a Russian organization, again, kind of intriguing. As far as I know, and I've talked to a couple of people, it's the first and largest, let's call it, civil society organization of its kind that approaches gun rights in kind of an American way.
Mm-hmm.
So there she is studying at American University, but what she was doing, and you can read about this, you know, I'm sure online, just check it out, but American intelligence says that essentially what she was doing is she was getting contacts, becoming kind of an agent, not a spy per se, but trying to make contacts who were influential in the Republican Party, in the NRA, and the gun rights movement in general. And she was also in very close touch with this man, Alexander Torshin. Now, Torshin is a Russian. He's a deputy head of the central bank in Russia. And he was, if you read some of this communication between them, encouraging her to, you know, go out, get these contacts in America. And It gets complicated, but she had other sources in Russia. Apparently, one guy who was funding her, he was kind of an energy consultant, whatever. But I think the, again, getting back to why she is intriguing is that she's a connection between the United States and Russia on this issue that you would say, why are the Russians dealing with this? I mean, Russian laws, in case you're interesting, are actually very strict. They would make gun rights, gun control, let's say,
Let's say a Seattle liberal gun control enthusiast.
They would be in heaven with the laws that are in Moscow
and
in Russia, because you have to be 18, you have to get a license from the police. There are no handguns, prohibited assault and combat weapons. Mainly it's the idea of if you have hunting guns, that's fine, but you can't carry them. You cannot carry them. Mm-hmm. You have to go through a safety and health, including mental health, which is a check, which is quite rigorous. No carry in self-defense, et cetera, et cetera. So the laws are actually pretty strict. Now,
So I could imagine someone who's with the Right to Bear Arms Committee in Russia, where laws are strict. Maybe they want to come over here and figure out how have you upheld the Second Amendment all this time and been so successful? Russia to have more of an American style approach to weapons.
Well, that's where it doesn't quite make sense.
Oh.
It's a little counterintuitive to me because, as I said, this is not an issue that Russians have traditionally been concerned about.
Uh-huh.
This is not something that they worried about. Now, recently, within the last, let's say, 10, 15 years, you've had some terrorist attacks, as we know.
Yeah.
And so Russians have gotten a little bit less confident that their government and local police can protect them. There have also been a couple of cases of kind of mentally ill people, weird cases of people opening fire, even sometimes with not very powerful weapons, but we would call them, you know, domestic terrorism type things, that have gotten Russians a little ill at ease about the situation. But I do not believe that there is a major movement. There's no comparison between the way Americans approach this Second Amendment and the way Russians do.
So then what do you think is really going on with people like Maria Butina, unregistered foreign Russian agent?
Well, I'm going to go out on a limb because I don't think anybody quite knows, but I think she was kind of the nexus in perhaps creating that organization in order to have some type of funding of her activities in the United States. Again, I do not have the proof for this, but it would appear to me that she was a good vehicle for anybody, let's say Russians who wanted to begin to interfere, get involved in, et cetera, issues that divide Americans. Because let's go back to 2016, and you could argue even before that. But 2016, one of the objects of the Russians was to sow dissent among Americans, to make them fight with each other. And the best way to do that is to take pre-existing hot button issues. You know, let's say abortion, racial relations, and gun rights. So Russia could come in, exploit this issue, exacerbate this issue, and just create the usual havoc that they were trying to do in 2016.
What would be an example then of how Russia would exploit a division that you said was already there, a pre-existing division, and how would that help Russia in any way?
Well, I mean, let's say creating dissension and hatred and anger among Americans is very useful because, of course, on the, let's say, the direct basis, it creates ferment in society, it weakens society, it pits Americans against each other. So just undermining which Russia, I'll tell you, I went to Russia in 1969 for the first time as a student. I've been there a lot. I lived there for almost a decade, 9 years. So this type of undermining the United States existed way before 2016. It was a Soviet thing, but it has been kind of turbocharged by social media and different things that we have right now in the United States and around the world that make it much easier to spread these messages. The other thing I would say there are so many ways they benefit. But another way is to look at the United States and to depict the United States as a place that has, it's all fake, this interest in human rights and values and sticking up for the little man and the legal system that supposedly protects you. That's all a lie. The United States doesn't really believe that.
And how does that help Russia?
It helps Russia because Russia can come in and say, you think the United States is a bastion of human rights? Just look what they're doing. And then you create Americans fighting. Racial issues are a perfect example of that. And so you demean and downplay and destroy the image of the United States as a country that tries to live up to values. So I would say that's, internationally, that's the most effective.
And the idea is to eventually weaken other countries' alliances with the United States?
Oh, sure. I mean, you don't have to have a complete objective. This is done in connection with other ways of attacking the United States. And I'm not trying to sound like an old cold warrior, but this really is what's happening right now. I mean, RT, television, et cetera, you have heard during the campaign, the Russians were funding two different people on two different sides of issues and actually encouraging them to go on the streets and have a demonstration at the same time. And then, of course, RT would show up and film it, videotape it, put it on TV, and there goes America. Not a very good example for the rest of the world.
So when it comes to this case before us of gun rights and this Bellevue gun rights activist and the Russian national, do we know what was the interaction there that she thought was forwarding Russian interests?
That I don't know. Mm-hmm. I mean, it appears that it's all part of kind of the gun rights, Second Amendment. Let's go to Russia. Let's talk to the people in Russia who are supportive of gun rights. Now let's have Russians come over here. That type of communication between both sides. I don't know the details, so I really can't talk specifically about that.
But her being an unregistered foreign agent, this is the charge against her, and is that just sort of a minor ticky-tack thing? Like, you didn't file the paperwork, or is this a significant charge?
No, because if you're, let's say, you're a lobbyist or you're trying to influence another country in order to promote the interests of, let's say, Russia, that's against the law. And that's a serious thing. Now, Russia, interestingly, the foreign ministry and others have mounted, and you can go online and see this, a massive social media campaign, Free Maria Butina. And it's very interesting because they are out. They are out to create a big wave of, this poor innocent 29-year-old. My goodness, she was just a student. How could she possibly do this? And so that's a big right now, just go online, check it out. It's very interesting.
So then finally, Jill, what are you looking for next on this story?
Well, I think we have to see how all of this kind of comes together. I would say specifically on 2016 and the influence in the election. I certainly know, and many experts know, that this was a multifaceted approach to influencing the election. There was military involved with the GRU, military intelligence, the 12 guys, the agents who were indicted a week and a half ago. You had RT television. You had, let's say, Maria Butina there, trying to get together with her friends who support gun rights. You had social media that were encouraging and stirring up a lot of concern. Certainly, the killing of young black men on the streets was another issue that they tried to exploit in a pretty major fashion. So whatever worked, and I do not think, Bill, that they really have any concern. Deep down inside, they have no concern for young black men on the streets being killed. They have no concern about gun rights. They have no concern about these issues, but they are a vehicle for pulling Americans apart.
We've been talking about the recent revelations of Russia's involvement ostensibly in the American gun rights movement, but what really might be going on with that and other cultural issues here in the USA. And we've been talking with Jill Doherty, a CNN contributor, a Russian expert, lived there for about a decade, a distinguished visiting practitioner now at the UW-Evans School of Public Policy and Governance. Really appreciate you telling us the story, Jill.
Yeah, thank you, Bill. I love your show.
Thank you so much. The record continues on KUOW in a moment. Next week, Seattle City Council will vote whether or not to regulate and charge dockless bike companies. You know, the Lime Bikes, OFO, Spin. We're not the first city to want to limit the sidewalk spread. Last month, Dallas passed a law to regulate their bike shares. The companies are now required to have a permit, and the city of Dallas now charges those companies about $20 per bike per year. Seattle's regulation could be similar. We'll talk about that. First, let's find out what's happened since Dallas did its thing. My guest is Robert Wolanski, city columnist and reporter for the Dallas Morning News. Welcome back, Robert.
A real pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Pleasure's mine. The last time we spoke, I remember you telling us about that it was the Wild West when it came to bike shares in Dallas, and now your city is doing some permitting. And what effect has that had?
Well, it's been interesting. I would say the city council passed the regulations on July 27th, their last meeting before they went on summer vacation. And in the last month, we've seen OFO leave Dallas. As I'm sure you know, OFO is leaving most of the markets they're in, many of the countries they're in. I believe they're only going to stay in New York, Seattle, and San Diego at this point. And Spin has also pulled out of Dallas, except for the couple of college campuses they're on. But Spin, it appears, is transitioning into the dockless scooter business, the electric scooters.
I've noticed more and more electric bikes here in Seattle. It seems like electric might be the way. I can understand in Dallas it must be pretty. It must be a little friendlier to be on something electric than be riding a bike in 100 degrees.
Well, let's put it this way. It isn't 79 degrees here today. In fact, I dare say it hasn't been 79 degrees here in about 3 or 4 weeks. And even that's at 2 o'clock in the morning.
I'll bet.
I was very skeptical of the electric scooters, but I have to say, when I ride them, at least I don't feel like I'm leaking sweat when I'm on those.
Right.
As opposed to, you know, pedaling here 2 blocks, you've lost your water weight for the week.
Yes, I've taken to carrying multiple undershirts. I got one on my desk at work and all that kind of stuff. And this ain't Dallas. What about OFO, though? This is a Chinese company, right? Why did they say that they're leaving Dallas?
Well, they say they left Dallas for the same reason they're leaving many of the markets they're in. It's simply not proving to be a profitable business, which I think is interesting given the fact that earlier this year they got about $800 million more in capital. So they are well-funded, but it appears that OFO is going the way of Spin, and even Lime, I dare say. Lime certainly has the electric scooters. I think the electric scooter and somewhere down the line the electric bicycle is going to be the future of this dockless shared transportation, certainly here. I would say that since those transportation regulations were passed, and again, it is $808 for the permit and $21 per bicycle, when those regulations were passed, OFO was the only company to complain about them. They said they were exorbitant fees and they were going to run them out of the market. But obviously, in the last couple of weeks, we saw that they were going to leave many, many markets. So I don't think those fees necessarily had something to do with them leaving Dallas. I simply think that there were five companies that came here since August. They competed for what was a fairly small market at this particular moment because we don't have, as I think I said last time, we don't have very good bicycle infrastructure here. We only have some 30, 40 miles of bike lanes, and most of those are shared lanes. There's only a handful of real protected bike lanes here.
Well, we do build protected bike lanes here, but we fight about it a lot, too.
Yeah, here we just fight about not building them.
Right. Robert, stay with us just a moment, because we have here in the studio next to me is David Gutman of the Seattle Times, transportation reporter who's following the bike share system here. Hi, David.
Hey, how are you doing?
I'm good, thank you. So how would you compare? We just heard from Robert about Dallas, where it was the Wild West, but now it's an $800 permit. It's $20 a bike per year. What is Seattle considering, and how would it compare to Dallas, the way we would treat our bike shares?
Well, what Dallas just set up looks a lot like what it's been like in Seattle for the last year, where mm-hmm. we've been operating under this pilot permit with pretty modest fees and not too much enforcement. Next week, the city council is going to vote on what would be more of a permanent program, which would more than triple the fees. It would be about $50 a bike. And Seattle wants to have four companies here, each of which would pay $250,000 a year to operate. And each of them would be allowed to have 5,000 bikes, so a total of 20,000 bikes in the city.
$250,000 a year just to operate compared with an $800 permit in Dallas.
Well, you've got to also include the per bike fee in Dallas, which is $20
instead of 50.
It's likely to be 50 here, and that would mean 20,000 bikes in the city, which is about twice as many as we have right now. We've had about 10,000, give or take, for the last 6 months or so. And the city would use that new revenue to monitor the system and also hopefully set up 150 to 200 kind of bike corrals, new bike parking spots around the city.
Yeah, bike parking is a big thing. How is Seattle going to deal with the complaints that whether there's some people just say, oh, it's visual clutter. And some people say, hey, I'm trying to get where I'm going. You know, this isn't even legal. This hasn't passed the Americans with Disabilities Act. You can't have bikes everywhere.
Well, the visual clutter complaint, I think there's not going to be done much to address that. If these bikes are going to be here, you're going to see them.
Mm-hmm.
The parking, they are going to try to address that. So Seattle did kind of a cursory evaluation earlier this year of the system and found that somewhere around 75 or 80% of the bikes are properly parked. Another maybe 15% of the bikes are improperly parked, but it's not a huge issue. They're not totally blocking the sidewalk. And then they found about 5% are blocking the sidewalk or blocking a curb ramp, which is a big issue. And so what the plan now is they're going to set some sort of benchmark, something less than that 5%, maybe 4% or 3%. And they say they're going to do semi-annual audits of each company to make sure less than that number of bikes are improperly parked. And if the company exceeds that number, there'll be punishments. They'll have to take bikes off the street or potentially fines, but more likely they'll have to take some of their bikes off the street.
Robert, is Dallas talking about bike corrals or docks or otherwise reining in the bikes lying hither and thither issue?
There are some bike corrals that have been put in by a downtown organization, Downtown Dallas Inc. did some bike corrals. The regulations say you can't keep bikes, you can't park a bike on a sidewalk that's narrower than 8 feet. The companies have a couple of hours when a call is placed to 311 by a complaint to come get the bikes and so forth. But yeah, I mean, the fact of the matter is we've simply seen the number of bikes drop precipitously in the last month to the point where that visual clutter issue, which was so prevalent here several months ago, has almost vanished. In fact, I dare say that I don't see many bikes downtown these days at all. You see a lot of the scooters, but you really don't see the bikes, and those scooters take up significantly less space, and they're collected every night because they need to be charged. So the clutter we saw here really has diminished significantly, I would say, in the last month alone.
David, do you expect bike share diminishment in Seattle?
Well, the city wants to double the number of bikes that we have right now. I think a lot of it will...
Would that be a general permit that could be a bike or a scooter?
No, scooters aren't coming just yet. The city wants to kind of get bike share under its belt first before they let scooters in. Whether, you know, we actually have 20,000 bikes, I think a lot of that will depend on the companies. If they decide it's profitable, OFO, you know, they left Dallas. It's unclear if they're going to stay here. They also spoke out publicly objecting to these proposed raised permit fees here. And I wouldn't be shocked if they end up leaving the city, although SDOT, the Seattle Department of Transportation, said that in their discussions with bike share companies, they've had 5 to 10 companies who are at least interested in coming here.
Well, David, you heard Robert tell you how attractive a scooter, an electric vehicle, is in the Dallas heat. You could say the same about Seattle Hills, I suppose.
You could absolutely say the same about Seattle Hills. I wouldn't mind scooting around on a scooter.
Any questions for one another before we let you go as we compare notes? A couple of city journalists talking bike shares in the city. Dallas there and Seattle here.
Well, I'm fascinated. Do you think that Seattle will be, 20,000 bikes in Dallas, we were swamped. Do you think Seattle can handle 20,000 bikes?
I mean, it's a big city. It's 80-some square miles. Obviously, the bikes will congregate in certain places. These companies are going to have to be vigilant about spreading them out, kind of recirculating them.
They tend to wind up at the bottom of hills.
They wind up at the bottom of hills. one of the companies that wants to come here is Jump, which is owned by Uber, and they're an all-electric bike fleet. So the more electric bikes are out there, the less likely they are all to end up at the bottom of hills.
Mm-hmm. Ours ended up at the bottom of lakes here.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah, there's that, too.
And, I mean, 20,000 is a lot of bikes, but how many cars are parked on city streets? A lot more than that, and each one takes up a lot more room than each bike. It's just we're a lot more used to seeing cars parked everywhere.
Is there a lot? Are there a lot of electric bikes in Seattle at the moment, or are they still mostly the manual?
They're still mostly manual. I'd say of the 10,000 we have in the city, probably somewhere around 2,000 are electric, but that's just a kind of ballpark guess.
See, we have none here, and I think that is going to be an interesting situation if, in fact, OFO decides to go to e-bikes or go all scooter, the way that Spin appears to be going all scooter. I think electric bikes is going to be the ultimate sort of future, the best of both worlds for people here.
I wouldn't disagree, although I think scooters might be as well, and they're not coming here yet, but who knows what will happen down the road.
Robert,
are they illegal in Seattle? Because they were illegal here until June 27th. And the fact is, you got to remember, in Dallas, the scooters are only on a six-month pilot, so the council may come back in 6 months or 5 months now and go, hey, we don't like these because there's been reports of people having accidents. The electric scooter here is still sort of, its future is a bit tenuous at the moment.
Sure. They're not, you know, privately owned electric scooters are not illegal, but the city has basically told all these companies, hey, don't drop 1,000 scooters on our street. You're not permitted to do that until we set up some sort of program, and the city is not in the process of doing that right now.
And yeah, we do have extra trouble with electric assisted vehicles on the sidewalks. You already have people walking on the sidewalks dealing with bicycles, and why aren't you on the street? And I think that ramps up when people are zooming around on electric stuff.
Well, that's been our problem here, and the fact is city ordinance actually disallows, by law, electric vehicles on public sidewalks or roadways. So the fact is they're operating now sort of, the ordinance has sort of been lifted, but the fact is it may go back into effect in 5 months. So it's not simply these private companies, but it's anybody with an electric scooter. They simply have been illegal here for a very long time.
I'll get a final word from David Gutman in a moment. Robert Wolanski, city columnist, reporter for the Dallas Morning News, figuring out bike shares just like we are. Robert, thanks. Good to talk with you again.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
David Gutman, Seattle Times transportation reporter. Any final word on bike shares and scooters and e-assists?
I think it's just going to be interesting to see if people keep using them and if these companies can actually turn a profit. I'm very dubious that any of them are profitable right now. It's only a dollar to ride these bikes, and they all have huge outside funding, but we'll see.
Well, their hope, I assume, is to get you hooked with a dollar a ride, and then that's going to go up, and they could certainly justify it with the permit fees.
Yeah.
Maybe.
Guess so.
We'll see. Yeah, and what kind of advertising can they get out of this? The funding model is a mystery. I'd really like to see how that works out. David, thanks a lot for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
David Gutman, Seattle Times, there talking about the regulation of dockless bikes, Dallas's experience, and a preview of what might happen here in Seattle. We'll be back with the record in just a moment. It's The Record on KUOW. I'm Bill Radke. We're live tweeting the show at KUOW, so come join us. Seattle scientists are trying to figure out how to cut diseases out of your DNA. And the creator of a cult classic says he's going to go back to the TV show that made him famous and reboot it with a black actress. Just a couple of the stories that caught our attention this weekend, and we're joined by our panel to discuss. Xiaoqing Chao, food journalist, author of Chinese Soul Food. Good to see you again.
Good to see you, Bill.
Hayat Noramine is a reporter for Seattle Met Magazine. Hello, Hayat.
Thanks for having me.
Good to have you here. Thanks for coming. And you wrote a piece, Hayat, this week in Seattle Met about the companies that are advancing gene editing. And by the way, I saw that HBO's John Oliver did a segment about gene editing being either a Jekyll or a Hyde.
This is a milestone that could one day erase hereditary conditions.
Some fear the technology could be used to create designer babies.
This technology has the potential to change our DNA and the DNA of all organisms, alive and extinct.
Could that lead to eugenics? Could that lead to new divides in humanity? I don't know. That stuff's scary.
Exactly. It seems gene editing is either going to cure all disease or kill every last one of us.
Hayat, you met both sick people and researchers in the Seattle area who are certainly hoping for more of the disease-curing part. I really enjoyed getting to know them. Will you kind of lay out what the situation is?
Yeah. So my story is a little bit about, Julie Negrin, who has dealt with a slew of disease problems in terms of Crohn's disease on her mom's side, Lynch syndrome on her dad's side. So she's just had to deal with a whole range of issues her whole life.
She's predisposed to a variety of cancers.
Yes, yeah, colon cancer, ovarian cancer, uterine cancer. So for her, this just reading about these this gene editing tool just really gave her a lot of hope. Not just for her, but for her nieces and nephews who could potentially have the same issues that she's having right now. They're considering testing for her nieces and nephews have a 50% chance of having Lynch syndrome as well.
Julie grew up in Redmond, and you profile some of the people working in Seattle to advance this gene editing.
Yeah, at the Allen Institute for Cell Science, they're doing all kinds of cool things. They're using this CRISPR-Cas9 tool, which is a gene editing tool that essentially slices a part of the DNA that's responsible for, a disease, potentially, not right now, but this is what it could be used for. And so CRISPR-Cas9 has the potential to slice out a part of the DNA that is responsible for disease and then essentially replace it with, this template DNA that is disease-free.
Yeah, and Xiaoqing, you read Hayat's piece and were pointing out that obviously when you get into changing people's DNA, you really got to think twice before you want to plunge down that road.
I was in communications for 6 years at the Institute for Systems Biology. And one of the things that I learned from working with the researchers there is that, science is slow. And so some of these fears and concerns that we have are very real concerns. But I think that also requires that we have very strong bioethical standards, and also to have the general population be more scientifically literate, because I think some of these extremes are the result, those fears are the result of the lack of knowledge, just of how science even works, how research works, how slow it is, all the different processes behind that, and the testing, the important testing that's involved with it.
Have you ever thought about whether if this choice were yours, if you could, for example, make your child possibly resistant to a hereditary disease, whether you would do that?
Yeah, I mean, I certainly think that there's a lot of potential there. I am kind of, skeptical as to how long this is going to take. And I do think there's a lot of fear-mongering going on when it comes to this gene editing tool. You look back on some things that we've discussed in the past and right now, and then those articles become a little bit laughable now, like, how we treated AI or the internet. So I just think there is a lot of fear mongering right now, and it'll take decades probably before, we have to worry about the ethical implications. I think right now it's just really exciting in terms of what it can do for people like Julie.
Right. So Xiaoqing, we could become more scientifically literate, but about what? About scenarios that we're maybe not facing yet, but could.
Well, but I still think that in general, if we understand what's happening, then, we're less likely to jump to the deep end, first.
Isn't a concern that first of all, there would just be, you have whole movies, Hollywood movies about gene editing gone wrong. But then there are just the idea that there are people with hereditary conditions, dwarfism, there are many examples who say, I want humanity to accept differences, not to try to eliminate differences.
Mm-hmm. It's true. And everybody has a different opinion on that. And I think that there are some things we could probably all agree on. Cancer sucks. Nobody wants to deal with that. And to the extent that we can make that, a cure is a strong word. Researchers hesitate to even use that word, but to make it treatable or to make it a more chronic disease, they're all for that. But yeah, some of these other issues that they potentially could apply this to, this technology to, yeah, there's a difference of opinion.
Hayat, what else do you want to say about this piece that we can read in Seattle Med in the new August issue?
Just go out and read it.
She wrote it, by the way.
Issue. It's certainly CRISPR-Cas9 is a powerful tool, and with power comes great responsibility. I agree that I think there's a lot of things that we can all agree on that, cancer sucks. So in that sense, I think there's a lot going on there that I'm excited to see what comes of it in the next few years.
And Hayat writes about the Allen Institute providing the cells used for this research, and they have the idea of creating this to be open source.
Yeah.
They're not charging the most they could. They want it to be available on an industrial scale, as you write. So you can read that piece in Seattle Met. And next, we want to talk about something that came up this weekend. On the much lighter side, I don't suppose either of you are Buffy the Vampire Slayer fans?
I can't say that I am.
Yeah.
I did not. I admit that I only watched one episode, but I do watch a lot of TV and I have a lot of opinions.
Yeah, this is just a sliver of the show we're talking about from the late 90s, early aughts.
You are the Slayer. To each generation, a Slayer is born. One girl in all the world, a chosen one, one born with
the strength and skill to hunt the vampires, stop the spread of their evil, blah, blah, blah. I've heard it, okay?
One chosen girl in the entire world, and what is she like? Well, that was Sarah Michelle Gellar in the original show, but the TV show is being rebooted this time, starring a black woman, and in fact, a black woman is the showrunner and a head writer, with the director being still Joss Whedon, and I wonder whether you think this is... I've heard a lot of different opinions. Good news, bad news, no news?
I think with more representation of women of color is always a good thing. Buffy the Vampire Slayer was such a powerful, strong female figure for a lot of young girls back in that time. And I think, especially in the sci-fi world, those are rare to come by. So I think, just thinking in terms of what Buffy the Vampire Slayer did back then, I think the next step in this new generation is to make her a person of color.
But Xiao Qing, you've heard the criticism of, oh, thanks for the TV show hand-me-down.
the criticism is that, if you want to feature a woman of color, that this person should have her own storyline versus a recast one. To some extent, I agree with that. But on the other hand, stories like recipes, it's not really a new story, right? The themes are pretty much the same. The details are different. The technology for driving that story is different. But I think in this case, it's such a well-recognized brand. Why not recast it in today's time?
It is a recognized brand. There's obviously financial imperatives here,
absolutely.
But there are people saying, look, just Google, black woman sci-fi Avenger or whatever. There's tons of stories, original stories done by people of color of all different kinds that, you don't have to just grab off the shelf the financial bonanza.
Well, but what's to say that those aren't already in development,
mm-hmm.
right? So this is just one avenue to take advantage of a well-known storyline. If all parties who are involved in it agree on how they're moving forward, I don't see why they couldn't take that tack.
This is food writer Xiaoqing Chao, who compared a script to a recipe. There are no new ideas in a certain sense. I want to talk about some food before we go. It's going to be 80 degrees all week or whatever, and good time to be on the water. So food writer Xiaoqing Chao, have you gone crabbing yet?
Yes, twice already.
Already?
Yep.
What's
yep.
the key to good, effective crabbing?
Turkey legs has worked really well.
Yeah,
for bait.
I've used a chicken.
Chicken, turkey leg works well. That's the well, I guess it's no longer a family secret. But
no, you just
gave it away.
Yeah.
But you know, soak the pots overnight and make sure you find a place that is not highly trafficked. Mm. Some people don't have a boat, and maybe they try to catch their crab off the pier or someplace that's closer to shore. But if you have access to a boat, have a friend or family member with a boat, do go out a little bit and try not to get in the way of the ferries.
Yeah.
Okay, you're lying.
Not a ferry lane.
In a propeller, that's bad.
I went out on a boat with a friend with 3 crab pots, and he had zinc weights that dissolve in salt water. So you sink your pots and no one knows where they are. And after a few hours, the zinc dissolves and the float pops up. And you got about 5 minutes before somebody else sees it and steals your pot. Somebody stole 2 out of our 3 pots,
and
we could see them speeding away. They were so fast. Hayat, are you a crabber?
No, but I'm happy to take crabs.
You didn't steal my crabs.
I'm happy to take crabs off of your hands.
Yeah, okay.
Have any.
Yeah, you need all kinds at the crab bake.
And you know, you don't have to just boil them or steam them. You can also stir fry them. So just saying.
Do you think that those people that stole our crabs measured them and threw back the ones that were too small because it would be unethical?
Unlikely. Unlikely. But yes, only take the males, and you're allowed only 5, and they have to be at least 6 1/4 inch across.
Yeah.
Yep.
Maybe they thought we left our pots down there. Have you heard about all the crab pots that people leave at the bottom of Puget Sound?
A lot of amateurs. I think that if you're going to do this, if you're going to partake in this Northwest tradition, then you have to take some responsibility to and report what your catch is.
And do we have enough crabs that I shouldn't feel bad about eating them? Because some people say when you eat local wild salmon, you're stealing the orca's food, just like those crab thieves stole my dinner.
You know, I think if it were a huge issue, that there would be tighter limits on what, you know, the season.
Yeah.
But right now, I haven't heard of any major issues with that. The only thing is Puget Sound waters aren't as clean as perhaps they are in Alaska or off the coast. And mm-hmm. So just be wary of that.
Okay. Well, you're going to tell us your secret spot?
No.
Good. I respect that. Xiaoqing Chao, a food journalist, author of Chinese Soul Food. Hayat Noramine, and we're not as veteran crabbers as Xiaoqing is, but we will both go to the stir fry, right?
Yes,
okay.
Definitely.
Okay, we'll see you there. Hayat Noramine is a writer for Seattle Met Magazine, a reporter there, and Xiaoqing Chao, Chinese Soul Food. Thanks to both of you for coming over and talking about what happened this weekend with us.
Thanks, Bill.
Thank you so much.
And thank you for tuning into The Record on KUOW Seattle. We are going to be back at you tomorrow. The show is produced by Amina Alsadi, Ajua Jima Brempong, Allison Bruzek, Sophie Reed, and Jason Pagano, our social media producers. Bri Ripley, talk to you tomorrow.